Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 16, Sidekick Showcase.
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
And we're talking today not about heroes, not about the main characters, but about their seconds, our friendly neighborhood sidekicks.
Oh, please, Dad. The term is hero support.
I can't say sidekick anymore.
Apparently not. Not according to the greatest film about sidekicks ever made.
But more about that later. But before we talk about comic book sidekicks, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the concept of sidekicks in other forms of literature.
Ooh.
So some other literary sidekicks. And I traced it back. I'm confident that I can go back to about 1600 and find a sidekick relationship. Certainly, I can go back 100 years. That's easy. But I was thinking, just how far back can we go to find a sidekick relationship with a main character or with a hero? I was thinking, could we go back 1,000 years into era of sort of medieval-type literature? And I came up with two that are close, but I think they're more a main character and his team.
All right.
So I'm thinking King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table.
Ooh.
You got, that's close there. You've got some Galahad, you've got a Lancelot, but I'm not sure that either one fulfills sidekickedness.
True, because most of the times, each of those characters went off and had their own adventures, which usually tended to be solitary. I think there are a couple stories where you have like a team up, almost, where Lancelot and Galahad are going and having an adventure and fulfilling a mighty, righteous quest. And in those cases, Galahad, being the youngest of the knights, sort of sometimes fits that sidekick role, that he's the wide-eyed, innocent, doesn't know anything about the world.
I think to some extent we are stretching it.
Yeah, I agree.
The other one similar that I thought of is Robin Hood and his Merry Men. Now, in the Disney version, Little John comes pretty darn close to being Robin Hood's sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if in the original tellings
that's
the case. Again, I think we have more a leader and a band.
Yeah, there is something of a leader, second-in-command band, but that's not quite the same thing. Because the key about a hero and a sidekick is that it is a two-man team. That's it.
Right. Now, I tried to go back 2,000 years and ended up with Jesus and the disciples. But I don't think that quite qualifies. There are times when Peter thought he was Jesus' sidekick.
Yeah.
But that, I don't think, is really quite the case.
I don't think that history and theology bared him out on that one.
Yeah. Now, I was trying to think, we had cases of pupil and student relationships of Plato and Socrates and Aristotle. And those relationships, again, I didn't think quite, I don't know the philosophers had sidekicks. So I don't know that that quite counts.
There's a case to be made with Plato.
Then I did go back even further, and I think I got a pretty good one from the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. And I mentioned this to you, and you actually, in terms of guessing or trying to deduce where I was coming from, had actually a pretty good suggestion.
The epic underappreciated duo that is David and Jonathan. David, the giant killer, king of Israel, etc., and his best friend, the former King Saul's son. And the two of them have a really interesting friendship and warrior bromance that I just think is excellent and a little bit underappreciated. That Jonathan's in something like 9 chapters of the Bible, that there are kings who don't get that much page time.
So I think, actually, David and Jonathan is pretty close. The one I was thinking was back a little further. You may know them from the Ten Commandments movie or from The Prince of Egypt. That would be the dynamic duo of Moses and Aaron.
Yes.
And I think that one's pretty close to a sidekick relationship. They are brothers, so we have older brother, younger brother. We have one who's the designated leader, Moses, but he does hand off some of his duties to Aaron. So I think that one's actually pretty close. to being a sidekick.
I think so. Now, I, of course, lean more towards my pick because I picked it. But something that I think that is important about a sidekick, and we'll talk about this in a little bit when we get to really splitting hairs, is that a sidekick does take an active role in the action. You know, I would say the fight, but right. It's not always a battle, though. Again, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, there was some serious throwing down.
True.
But that the sidekick is heavily involved, as opposed to being a supporting character who maybe supplies technology or information or something like that, but a sidekick is actually in the field.
Right, which is why I'm pretty confident that my 1600 version definitely qualifies. These other ones were somewhat flights of fancy, I will admit to that. But I'm pretty sure if we go back to really when literature moved from drama and epic poetry actually into the novel, with Cervantes' Don Quixote being considered the first modern novel, the first story told in that structure, outside of the epic poem structure or the dramatic play structure. And I think there the character of Sancho Panza comes really close to being a modern sidekick. And I think from a literary perspective, he fulfills one of the duties, again, not within the story, but from the author's perspective, of what a sidekick does, which is gives us as the readers an in to the story, an in to the character. And probably the best example would be, I think, going back just 100 years, no doubt, that Watson counts as a sidekick to Sherlock Holmes.
Absolutely. I love your pick when you said that Sancho Panza is the first sidekick. I was like, oh, yes, absolutely, because his role in the story is to help the reader connect to the main character, but also kind of to poke fun at the main character in that story in particular. I think he has one of my favorite lines in all of literature, which is something to the extent of, "You are the fallow fields of justice to which I am the manure. Let me fertilize the lands of your great deeds with my odor." Something to that extent. And it's one of the greatest things I have ever read. I died. I've only read about 10 pages of Don Quixote, and it had that line, and I was like, okay.
But I think in Quixote and in Holmes, we do see, again, literarily, the value of the sidekick, because in both cases, those main characters, the leads, are
unrelatable.
Don Quixote, because he's mad, and Sherlock Holmes, because his brain operates on a totally different level from everyone else's. So we as readers need someone to identify with, someone through whose POV we can see the story and see the events unfolding. So that's Sancho Panza, and that is literally, in the case of the vast majority of the Holmes canon, they are written first person from Watson's memoirs. I believe at least 52 or 54 of the 56. It may actually be all of them, but I believe there are a few where Doyle experimented and there's a different literary form. But the vast majority of them are first person Watson's reminiscences. So that's an example of us being given a character to identify with. And I think that is an easy analogy to what comic book writers deal with, where the sidekick, whether it's a kid sidekick or not, but certainly being a kid sidekick, I think, helps. But just in general, the sidekick is usually the person that we can identify with because we can't identify necessarily with the superpowered character.
Now, let's talk about that for a second. And we haven't necessarily given a strict definition of what a sidekick
is
thus far. We've sort of danced around,
circled around a little bit. What would you say?
I would say that a sidekick in relation to a hero forms, as I said, a duo, not part of an ensemble team. The sidekick is the humanizing force and either tends to be less powerful or younger in order to sort of make the hero look good. That their role really is to be a support to the hero, but they do still take an active role in the story, that they still do have their own powers and right. abilities and strengths as a character within the story, that they're not just sitting on the sidelines.
Now, we do have a little bit of a countdown to go through.
Yes.
And as we talk about these examples, we can sort of maybe tease out the definition of sidekick and give some maybe alternative terms for something. It's not a sidekick. They're really something else.
Exactly.
So where we're going to go is to my friend Paul O'Connor's blog called longboxgraveyard.com. So what a lot of blogs do, you know, every March is they do their bracket challenge where you vote on your favorite so-and-so and you narrow your field down. Paul did that with sidekicks. Now, I don't think this was his list of the top 16 sidekicks. I think he picked these to be examples. And so he picked 16 sidekicks and then ranked them 16 to 1 or seeded them. And that's how we're going to count them down. And by talking for a minute or two about each of these characters, we can maybe get a better handle on what exactly a sidekick is. For example, his number 16 does not count.
No.
Snapper Carr, sidekick to the entire Justice League of America. Not really.
I had never heard of this character until I saw this. That I was just like, Snapper Carr. Google? I'm gonna be honest, I was a little unimpressed. I was expecting, I don't know, some like half fish boy or something.
No, he's not a snapper. No. He's not proto Aqualad. No.
He's just some punk kid who hangs out in the Justice League's basement. Like, I do not think that he meets the criteria of a sidekick.
We think he is more likely a mascot.
Mm-hmm. That this was something that Dad brought up that I had never really thought that much about, but that it's almost a bit of a trope that there are mascot characters, that there are characters who ride this line between sidekick and just sort of general supporting character who don't really tend to be directly involved with the story, with the action. They're just sort of around and make jokes and serve some of the roles that we would associate with a kid sidekick, but aren't actual fighters, don't have powers. They're just sort of there more for like comic relief and a little bit of character relatability.
Says Snapper Carr. No.
No.
Number 15, Bob, Agent of Hydra, Deadpool's favorite whipping boy.
Once again, one that I had never heard of. I thought that this was actually Bob, henchman of the Joker, who I would say almost counts as a sidekick because he got his own action figure.
But let's go back to Bob, Agent of Hydra.
Less
though
cool.
You do...
Calling it
you
less
do,
cool.
You do raise an interesting point. Can a villain have a sidekick? Or does a villain have to have henchmen? Or minions? I don't want to spoiler ahead, but we will have a more detailed version of this conversation later in the list.
I will say, for now, perhaps. Because I think the defining characteristic of a minion is that they are subservient and they don't stand up to the villain. They just sort of run around and do it the bidding. And henchmen are uniform. So you can be both a henchman and a minion, but...
Those roles are a little bit different.
But they have a large overlap. But the henchmen are specifically characterized by being uniform. That the soldiers of Hydra... They are henchmen because they're all in the uniform. AIM is basically an entire organization of henchmen.
Doombots?
Doombots. They're all henchmen because they're all identical. They all serve the same role. They're just the oil in the cogs of the machine of villainy.
That's good. Number 14, Stripesy. He's the adult sidekick to the Star Spangled Kid. A little creepy. But at the time, it was revolutionary, because remember, in literature, as we were talking about, the idea of the kid sidekick was not the norm. The idea was a
right.
sidekick was just a sidekick. In medieval times, we may have had knights and squires or mm-hmm. knights and pages, which may have served some of those functions, but generally...
A page is almost a good guy henchman. They're just sort of... They're almost a minion. They're just here to do all right. the dirty work. That right. They don't really get to enjoy the benefits of glory. They're just sort of there.
But then it's when we moved into comic books that the idea of kid sidekick became dominant. So when you had a kid hero, the Star-Spangled Kid, the... unique spin on that was the adult sidekick.
Which is an interesting concept that I've done a decent amount of thinking about heroes and sidekicks and twists on the formula and stuff. I love this sort of thing. But that is an interesting idea because if Robin is the hero and he's, you know, 10 or 12, not 16, 18, 25, how's he going to get to the consulate that he is appearing at to meet a foreign dignitary? Because he can't drive, and most cabbies won't even take him, because you need ID.
And you need to be 25 to rent a car anyway.
Yeah, if you're traveling long distance and you need to stay in a hotel room, you don't have a cover because you're just some kid traveling on their own. That's weird. Now, a kid with an adult sidekick is weird. A kid traveling without any sort of adult supervision, out of costume, that's weirder.
Then we get maybe into a more traditional sidekick character, number 13, Aqualad.
I like Aqualad. I like Aquaman, and people crap on him all the time, and I'm really tired of it because there's actual legit evidence for his badassitude.
We call that the last 5 years.
Yeah, the last five
certainly
years of
comics. Certainly the new
52. Oh, God, yes.
And he was building up to that beforehand, too.
Oh, it's so good. Not even that, I'm just going to say, Justice League Unlimited Aquaman. He had a hook hand! He had long hair and no shirt. It's amazing.
I thought Brave and the Bold, Aquaman.
It's a different kind of awesome. I would say a kind of awesome, which is not very, but...
sacrilege.
To each their own. Aqualad has had less of a sort of iconic incarnation. That you've got his 60s, you know, underwater Robin. That's really all he was. And then, you know, you've had a couple different versions. In the Teen Titans, he was very sort of anime attractive guy looking. In the Young Justice cartoon, he was black and had a white buzz cut and looked like a badass and was amazing. There has been less evidence, we shall say, of Aqualad's awesomeness. And so I consider myself a champion of that cause. Recognize Aqualad's awesomeness.
Number 12, speaking of cool... the epitome of cool. I know, it's epitome.
Arthur the Moth.
Ironic sidekick to the ironic Tick.
I love Arthur.
Now, our experience with the Tick is not in the comic books.
No.
Or not even in the animated series.
Mine was. You were all about the live action.
I was all about the live action. And in the live action Tick, Arthur is awesome.
Oh my God, yes. He's so amazing.
We get adult sidekick to adult superhero. I like that.
Which is noticeably less creepy and still a pretty interesting twist on the, we will say, the now appearing tropes of the genre. Because if you go back early in literature, it was adult-adult. Then once you got into comics, it was adult and the kid sidekick. Now, going back to that, I like it. Also, the Tick really does need adult supervision, basically at all times.
Yes. So Arthur gave us that. And to some extent, he is Sancho Panza.
Very much so,
trying
yeah.
to bring a level of...
sanity.
Sanity, reality to the mixed up mind of the Tick.
Yes. Also, certified public accountant.
It's hard to beat that. Number 11, Fallout Boy. Faithful companion of the Simpsons' Radioactive Man.
I don't know anything about Fallout Boy, except for the band... because I have never watched The Simpsons.
RelativelyGeeky@gmail.com.
No, I've just never watched it, so I just don't know anything about this guy. I know he's...
There's a band.
There is a band.
Number 10, Skeets, partner and foil to Booster Gold.
This is where we get another one of those characters that sort of rides the line of what is and isn't a sidekick.
Yeah, there's... Is he... more of an assistant? Is he a partner? Is he support team? Where exactly does Skeets fit in?
Because something interesting about Skeets is that, you know, his primary role is not to kick ass and chew bubblegum. It's mostly scanning and getting information. And that's something that we would say is more support team of someone, of the guy in the van. And that in and of itself is almost its own trope. I think Blade has a guy in a van. Punisher has a guy in the van. Oracle was everybody's girl in the cave. Basically the same thing.
Arrow has a girl in the cave.
Yep, Arrow has a girl in a cave. So, okay, so it's guy in a van and girl in a cave.
I'm going to try to not read anything into that.
Leverage has a guy in a van, and he's awesome.
Now we've got another Golden Age sidekick, Toro, the partner of the original Human Torch, back in the Golden Age of Marvel. Marvel, back in the 40s, had Namor and their original Human Torch as characters. I did see, in doing just a little bit of research, that in the 40s, Toro and, spoilers, Bucky Barnes had a short-lived comic series called something like The Fighting Allies.
Young Allies.
The Young Allies, and the one issue whose cover we saw had Toro flying in while Bucky was punching the Red Skull into Hitler.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Hello! We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, after a few promos, we're going to cover the top 8 on the Long Box Graveyard list of sidekicks, and then talk about one of our favorite movies all about the sidekicks.
Sky High.
Wait, he said Mongo, didn't he? That's wrong character, wrong universe, and wrong galaxy. Hold on just one sec. Ah, here we go. Flash Legacies, a podcast chronicling the adventures of Wally West, the third hero to be known as The Flash. Join me, Dave Walker, in my bi-weekly journey as I look at Wally's career from when he first donned the mantle of the Flash all the way up to the return of Barry Allen. Find me at flashlegacies.libsyn.com.
He joined the Crusade. He helped rule the night. He fought for justice. He wore short pants. Okay, so Robin didn't always have the best fashion sense. But there's no way that he should be ignored, ridiculed, or even derided. He's been an important part of Batman's history for nearly 75 years, and that's why I've decided to give him his due in Taking Flight. Presented by the Batman Universe, Taking Flight is a podcast dedicated to all incarnations of the Boy Wonder. And every episode, I take a look at the adventures of Dick Grayson, Jason Todd, Tim Drake, Stephanie Brown, Damian Wayne, and all the others who have worn the red, green, and gold at the side of the Caped Crusader. New episodes appear every 2 weeks at the Batman Universe, which can be found at thebatmanuniverse.net. So join me, Tom Paneris, as I put the spotlight on the greatest sidekick in comicdom. Teenage anarchist.
And we're back with the top 8 sidekicks from Longbox Graveyard. Number 8, Speedy, sidekick to Green Arrow.
And as we continue this countdown, we will run into more eventual members of the Teen Titans, which probably just has to add to Aqualad's feeling of inferiority. Because even though he made the list, yeah, he is the lowest rated Teen Titan on the list.
Mm-hmm. Speedy has had a pretty, I will say, interesting history in comics. He is actually one of the few sidekicks who was ever part of an official non-sidekick specific team. That back in the 40s, there was this little team called the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And something that's interesting about it was that the seven characters included two kids and two sidekicks, since the members included Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy, as well as Green Arrow and Speedy. So that is just an interesting thing of note, that Speedy as a kid sidekick still made the list. Unfortunately, that's almost the peak of his career.
To be fair, his most famous moment is...
when it turns out he's addicted to heroin. Yeah, I'm going to be getting to that soon in my other show, Uncovering the Bronze Age, because one of the most famous stories of the Denny O'Neill-headed Green Lantern Green Arrow series was when it was revealed that Green Arrow's sidekick was addicted to heroin. It's a very good story. It is a surprisingly subtle story for Denny O'Neill GLGA that deals with all these issues of addiction and inferiority and what it's like being a kid sidekick and how Speedy felt that he needed some escapism. And it's a surprisingly interesting psychological portrait. But when your most well-known story is about you being a junkie, it's kind of hard to come back from that and have a ongoing, focused series that is not going to continually deal with the fact that everyone knows you as a junkie. Even though he got clean, he had a daughter, it was awesome, and then Cry for Justice happened. Now she's dead and he doesn't have an arm, and then it got rebooted, and now he's hanging out with Naked Starfire. It makes me sad. But Speedy is an awesome character. He was in the Titans. He's cool. He grew up and actually became a hero, like an adult hero for a little while, which was awesome and happens surprisingly infrequently that there are all of these kid sidekicks who are mentored by heroes. And a lot of times they don't tend to go on to have their own independent heroic stories. He became Arsenal and that was cool. Now he's playing second fiddle to Jason Todd. Like,
that's not good.
I'm just saying.
That's not good.
Poor Roy Harper has had a rough, rough life the last, like, 40 years. That's the worst part about being a sidekick. You're going to be going through puberty for, like, 35 years. Just, oh, God.
Well, let's get to someone with a much more simpler timeline.
Oh, awesome.
Much more straightforward, easy to comprehend. Number 7, Wonder Girl. Uh-oh.
Oh. Oh, Donna Troy.
So that's part of the problem.
Before that, she was Diana. Was she?
They did Wonder Girl stories with Diana as a girl on Themyscira. There were occasionally Wonder Baby stories as well.
Right, but we don't talk about those.
No. But the Wonder Girl story was simply Wonder Woman as a younger person, in the same way that for the longest time, Superboy stories were stories of Superman as a younger person. It was the identical concept. Somewhere along the line in the creation of the Teen Titans, whether there was a miscommunication, a misunderstanding, Wonder Girl was brought into the Teen Titans at the same time where Wonder Woman was an existing character in her own right.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little bit of retconning to come up with the Donna Troy version.
This is one of those unfortunate things about having the symbolic covers, which I know a lot of people love. I sometimes enjoy them. But there is a little problem that comes up if you're not actually portraying what's going on in the story, that one of the editors just looked at one of these covers for Wonder Woman, and it said, the continuing story of Wonder Girl. And it has Wonder Girl running around with Wonder Woman.
We call that in the editorial biz a whoops.
Yes. Yes, that is exactly what that is.
To be fair, they managed to turn Donna Troy Wonder Girl into a pretty compelling character in her own right.
She is pretty cool.
Certainly in the Wolfman Perez version of Teen Titans.
Yes.
Wonder Girl really comes into her own.
Interesting and engaging character, regardless of her muddy origins.
Now, picking up on a conversation we had earlier, number 6, Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn.
Does Harley Quinn count as a sidekick?
Yes.
Well, no, we were supposed to discuss, debate, think about it longer than that.
Do you have an alternate case to make? She has a matching costume that is thematically relevant to her hero.
I believe the here's our technicality.
She serves as a relatable force to help understand the mind of the insane Joker. Not necessarily to sympathize with him, though there have been their moments. She is funny and humanizes the character to which she is, well, often dehumanizes because he's incredibly abusive towards her, our character. She serves all of the roles of a sidekick. And she's funny.
But he's a bad guy.
And she's dressed up in like a thing with like the hat and
Jester and the
and
this
she's and she's got face paint and she's a adorable blonde and she's cute and shut up. Harley Quinn's awesome.
And she's a sidekick.
Yes, she is.
Number five. Of course, back to the Teen Titans, Kid Flash.
We are going to say Wally West, Kid Flash?
I believe so.
Okay.
We've talked about on the podcast before that you are a fan of the legacy characters,
mm-hmm.
especially the Flash family.
I love it. Yeah.
So where are you on Barry versus Wally as Kid Flash versus graduating to become the Flash? For quite a long time, actually, I think of the people on this list, I think it's probably safe to say that Kid Flash is the one that had the most success, long-term publishing success, taking on the mantle
of his mentor.
Of the mentor, as a fan of the Flash legacy concept.
Well, being introduced to the Justice League via the animated series, Wally was actually my first Flash. That when I first was introduced to the character, I didn't meet him as Kid Flash. I met him as the legit actual Flash. And then, for me, then when it went back and we met his mentor, and we met the Garricks, that's always been my sort of anchor, is with Wally as just the younger Flash, with Wally in like his mid to late 20s, and then with Barry in like his mid to late 40s. And then if you want a Kid Flash, you have Bart.
Question for you in terms of your DC animation history growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Wally was the Flash in the Justice League,
mm-hmm.
along with John Stewart, Green Lantern.
That is correct.
Was Kid Flash in the Teen Titans cartoon?
Oh, I'm trying to remember because I think there was a speedster. He was not on the core team because the core team was Cyborg, Beast Boy, and Robin as the dudes. That was it. But there were a couple of episodes where they were hanging out with like the Titans West or Titans East. There was like an alternate Teen Titans like team that was running around. They had a speedster. I think it actually might have been Impulse. Like, I think it might have been Bart.
That actually makes sense. I was just wondering if, since Wally was in the Justice League, if Wally was simultaneously in the Teen Titans.
And yeah.
I would think not. That's just my question.
Well, because there have also been a lot of debates about, in the Teen Titans, which Robin it was. I've always thought it was Tim Drake. There was some questions about that because then he was with Starfire, so it has to be Dick. And there was one time where he went into the future and he became Nightwing, and they're like, obviously that means he's Dick. And I'm like, no, because by that point Dick has gone on and become Batman. Like, that's my headcanon. Dick Grayson always eventually becomes Batman because at some point Bruce Wayne is gonna die, you know. Batman will become Terry McGinnis, which is awesome, but there's still like a 30-40 gap there where Dick could move up and become Batman. But
interesting. Now, you know, there's debate among Flash fans in the comic book world as to whether in the New 52 reboot, whether the, and also I guess on the Arrow TV show, where you're introducing a Flash into a new world, that it always has to be Barry. You always have to start with Barry. Even though, as we said, Wally had quite a long tenure as the title character of that book. He was the Flash for a couple of decades.
I mean,
it was not just a brief one miniseries and then he's gone. He held that role for quite some time. I think it's a shame that he sort of very easily gets cast aside.
Yeah.
At least in the Green Lantern world, there's room for many Green Lanterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have Guy and John and Kyle, and Hal, and Alan Scott, sort of all existing in a world if you want them to. But somehow, with Flash, the default is always to start with.
Yeah.
To always start with Barry.
And, you know, again, this is just my headcanon, but, you know, I always assume that at all times, both Barry and Wally are active Flashes in my head. That I always assume that. Because they're only about 15 years different from each other. Like,
right. It's not father and son, isn't it? Nephew?
Nephew. Yeah. So it. I always assume that they are both active Flashes at basically at all times. And that, of course, Jay's in retirement and Bart's in training. At least in my mind, whenever I think about Flash, I sort of think of the two of them sort of like splitting up the U.S. Each of the heroes sort of has their own turf.
Maybe Central City is like Springfield. So they could each be in Central City.
Yeah.
Barry could be in Central City, Ohio.
And
Wally's out in Central City,
Kansas. You know, it's all good.
It works.
Whatevs. That's just what I've always assumed, that they are sort of not in a hero-sidekick relationship, nor even in a direct team-up, partnership-team relationship, but they are both sort of parallel Flashes.
Both at the hero level.
Mm-hmm. Both working alone as the Flash.
So in your version of the DCU, there's not a Flash of two worlds. There's a world of two Flashes.
High five. That's awesome. And yes.
Moving into the top four seeds. Moving away from DC, back into Marvel. Rick Jones, sidekick to everybody.
Yeah, Rick Jones is an interesting character. I have never actually run across him in almost anything. I think there have been references to him in, like, Fantasticast, because there was that one time that they fought the Incredible Hulk. But that's really the only exposure I've ever had to Rick Jones. Like, I hear that he's an interesting and engaging character, but I have no experience with him.
Yeah, Rick was on the scene when Banner became the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some connection there and some feelings of almost responsibility,
mm-hmm.
Given certain versions of the backstory. And then it sort of became tough to be the Hulk's sidekick at certain times, again, depending on how they're writing the Hulk. So when Cap came back, and he was, for quite some time, very distraught about the death of Bucky,
mm-hmm.
when, and you know, in those early Man Out of Time stories, he was disconnected from
the world in general.
Yeah, from the world in general, but from the Avengers, rest of the Avengers. And Rick Jones sort of pined and wanted to be the replacement Bucky. Mm. So sort of in the same way, remember in the 70s, the great Power Man Iron Fist Heroes for Hire concept?
Good.
Rick Jones was pretty much sidekick for hire.
Oh, okay.
I think that was sort of his role.
So he was sidekick without a hero?
Pretty much. Pretty much. I think that
it's a little unfortunate.
Look, I'm a big fan of Paul O'Connor and the Longbox Graveyard site. I think Rick Jones was overseeded.
Yeah.
I do not think he should have been the fourth seed in this competition.
He probably shouldn't have been above Speedy, who is an actual sidekick.
He is a step above Snapper Carr.
But they're both filling a similar-ish sidekick slash mascot slash supporting character-ish sort of thing. We have one more of these coming up.
But fortunately for Bucky Barnes, number three, at least he is higher rated than Rick Jones. That would have been an insult.
That would have been really, really, really unfortunate. Oh, sorry. Your replacement made it higher on the list than you did.
Now, of course, if we were, say, the Back to the Bins podcast, this show would have been the obligatory cashing in Winter Soldier search engine optimization episode.
But we would never do that.
We're a little too classy for that.
Definitely. But let's talk about how...
Though we could call this episode Bucky Barnes and Other Sidekicks. So Bucky comes in at number three, by the way, the highest ranking Marvel sidekick. And I would say rightly so.
No, I agree. Bucky is not only a central character of the Marvel Universe, since both as the sidekick of Captain America, but as the Winter Soldier. He really is an important member of the universe, but also of the history of sidekicks. That now the dates are a little fuzzy, it's all early, but to the best of my knowledge, Bucky Barnes is the first of the kid sidekicks. That he is definitely in that first wave of making the adult hero with a kid sidekick relatable character for the kid readers. He sort of started that trend. So especially for our show, where we're talking about the history and importance and role of sidekicks in comics, it's really important that he's this high on the list.
In the comics, of course, we think he dies. Spoilers, he's the Winter Soldier.
I think it's a little late for spoilers at that point. At this point. Have you been on the internet in the last week?
Question for you, because this is a debate.
Yes.
In comic books, dead never means dead.
Oh, yeah.
There's some argument among fans, not so much about the movie, but about the Winter Soldier arc, which I actually thought was incredibly well done. The original Ed Brubaker arc of that story, I thought was terrific. But the issue is, are there some characters that should stay dead? And if you think so, Bucky is almost always on that list. Or until the Winter Soldier comic story, he was always on that list, along with Uncle Ben and a very few others on that short list of these guys really should have stayed dead.
I have not yet heard a bad thing about the original Winter Soldier storyline. Period. Except they should have left Bucky dead. I don't know. I have a tenuous relationship with the concept of death in comics. A lot of times death ends up feeling cheap, or if death is treated genuinely, the fact that characters will then return from death makes it cheap. It's one of those things that I'm not going to go so far as some people, like one of my favorite comic reviewers, Linkara, Lewis Lovehog, he always says, why would you kill characters? He's like, I don't get why you kill characters, because all you're doing is removing the ability to tell stories about that character. You know, he and I are on the same sort of wavelength about the multiverse. Like, just, if this character doesn't need to be here, put them in a different universe, give them a costume and some powers, and tell stories about them. I'm not quite that far on the extreme of never kill characters. I'm also not on the side of, if a character's dead, they need to stay dead forever and ever, amen. Because, I mean, Jean Grey. I am not a huge X-Men fan, but I love a lot of X-Men stories that have happened post death and return, and death and return, and death and return of Jean Grey.
I do think in Bucky's case, I think even if you hold to the, if they're dead, they should stay dead, because as you said, it does cheapen the death. I think the long span of time that Bucky was dead made the return a real surprise.
Right.
I do agree that death is cheapened if it's reversed 2 issues later, 4 issues later. I think the longer you can keep the character dead, I think that's one of the strengths of the death and return of Superman storyline, is the amount of time that he stayed dead and the terrific stories that were told.
It was like 18 months or something, wasn't it?
Somewhere
it was a long time.
In that ballpark. And he told some really good stories in that time frame. And so I think bringing Bucky back does not necessarily diminish his death, because such a long time in the publishing world had passed. So to me, there's almost a pass that I can give to that. It helps that the comic book story of his return was really, really good.
Yes. When it comes to these sorts of debates of, like, are you anti-character return or pro-character death or whatever, like, however we want to throw this out in terms, whenever anyone asks me anything that's relevant to those, I think I always just come back to just tell a good story and I'm going to be cool with it. If you're going to bring a character back from the dead, have a damn good story to bring them back to. If a character is going to die, they better die in a damn heroic way. For example, Supergirl. Pre-crisis Supergirl. That was awesome. That was an amazing death scene. And the fact that she has since come back several times through reboots and aliens and whatever does not make that scene and story any less awesome.
We talked about retcons in prior episode, and certainly bringing a character back from the dead, I think, would be a subset of retcons. I mean, obviously, it fits in that,
right.
It almost fits in that category of the retcon and how you feel about characters coming back from the dead, I imagine, is also how you feel about continuity and retcons.
Yeah.
I would assume that for most people, those are running connected on parallel tracks.
Yeah.
Those are connected.
And I actually had this debate right after the Avengers. This is, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is not even a twinkle in the network's eye yet. But immediately after the Avengers, when Phil Coulson died, I watched it with a couple of people, and one of them is a very ardent, like, Avengers fangirl. And she, played it and then watched a couple of bits and then was like, let me show you this, and was pulling up all this stuff on Tumblr and stuff. And she's like, there was a whole hashtag running of Fury Lies, Phil Coulson isn't dead. And I was like, I kind of want him to stay dead. And I had this discussion with her, and she was like, well, why would you say that? He's such a cool character. He's so fun. He's so awesome. He's so likable. And I was like, yes, those are all true. But his arc was awesome. And his death was amazing. Now, sections about his death were already lied about. You know, the whole thing with Fury saying, you know, having the cards with Phil's blood on them and all that in order to manipulate the Avengers. But then I was like, well, but if he wasn't really dead, then that means Fury double lied. Like, which I don't have a problem with for Fury, but then it double cheapens the scene. And I was like, I really don't like that. What I always say when it comes to you shouldn't kill characters, or you need to take death more seriously, or you can't cheapen death, I'm like, no. I'm okay with the fact that death is cheap in comics. That's just part of the genre. People come back to life. People are cloned. People are robots. It happens basically all the time. The key is that there are things worse than death. And those are the things that you need to be afraid of in comics. You don't have to worry about dying. There are things much worse than dying, as Phil Coulson learned.
Because as the guys at Dinner for Geeks demonstrated in their Everybody Hates This, Everybody Loves This episode, that about half their respondents were, everybody hates Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I love it.
Yeah.
So how can that many people love it if everyone hates it? So I think the impression is that everyone hates it.
It's a very likable show. It's Phil Coulson's show. Of course it's likable.
Is he Nick Fury's sidekick?
He started off as a henchman. He was just merely a background character. Then he tried to become Captain America's sidekick. Then he died, and now he's a hero in his own right.
He is such a Rick Jones. Sidekick number two. Way overseated. He is here simply on name recognition, despite, I would say, a lack of sidekickery.
Mm-hmm.
James Olsen. We're not really fans.
Not really, no.
Just not a sidekick.
He really isn't.
Even as Turtle Boy.
Nope.
And as I have emailed many times to Billy Hogan on the Superman Fan Podcast, they're not really pals either.
No.
That is a very strange definition of the word pal.
Jimmy Olsen might be Superman's pal. Superman is not his pal.
No. You don't. Friends don't treat their friends like that.
Friends don't leave friends to die in the desert.
Pretty sure I have that as a bumper sticker. So let's move on.
He's a side character. He has no powers. He is...
Turtle Boy.
He is almost universally in
his... Elastolad.
He's basically in his own stories.
Nightwing and Flamebird.
Yeah.
One's close. But no, we're not counting
that
him as
happened,
a side character.
But it doesn't count.
He
does
is
not
a
count.
Side character.
Mm-hmm.
Support character.
He is a supporting character.
Not a sidekick.
Nope.
Number one, of course, Robin.
Yeah!
By the way, just as a point of information, fortunately, in the voting, Jimmy Olsen was defeated. I believe he was defeated by Wonder Girl.
Oh, yeah!
Which I like to hear. As of this recording, and as of the day that this will release, there is still a few more days to vote in the final. Longboxgraveyard.com, the final two, Robin versus Bucky.
Oh, yeah.
Which, to be fair, is a pretty good sidekick showdown.
Oh, it is.
So, Robin, I think the assumption here is Dick Grayson.
Yes, but that is the interesting thing about Robin, is that there have been many Robins, the vast majority of them awesome, many of them beloved. One of them is Jason Todd.
I was going to say, of all the Robins, fans have actually only voted to kill one of them.
Which, if you take, you know, out of nine, if you include
everybody you could possibly think of,
and
that's not that bad.
It's like what, like 11%?
That's not so bad.
That's not awful.
I would vote for Robin over Bucky in terms of best sidekick ever.
I agree. Bucky is a cool character. As a sidekick, not terribly interesting.
You know, Robin introduced at about the same time. And in right. the Golden Age, they basically served the same function.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, Robin has gone on to have an uninterrupted 74 years.
I would say the two of them are interesting in that they've each taken a different route to a similar place. That in Bucky's case, it was die and be removed from comics for a vast amount of time and then come back as an adult character. Whereas Robin had to take the long way around and actually spend all of the time in the tiny boy shorts and then in the pants, and then he was Nightwing, he had a stupid collar, and now he's headlining his own book. It's taken him a really long time to get there, but the two of them have now reached similar places that they have managed to break out of this trap.
That's true.
That we talked about with Kid Flash, of the trap of the perpetual, eternal sidekick. And I think in Robin's case, a lot of that is because Robin has become a legacy character. That they did allow Dick Grayson to grow up and then got a new Robin. And then they killed him off, and then they got a new Robin. But with that, where there's that emphasis that Robin is a teen, Robin is really like a role. Like, it's a...
Right.
It's almost like a rank or something, like a military rank that you hold for a certain period of time, but it can be filled by basically any character, as Carrie Kelly proved. Right. Doesn't even have to be a guy. Doesn't even have to be that young. But just that they serve the role of the quipster to keep the hero grounded, but also to be a motivating force to keep Batman out of his dark and gloomy cave and the crushing nihilism. That as long as the character is athletic and jumps around and punches bad guys in the face, they can be Robin. And then the character themselves can grow on and become Nightwing or become Red Hood.
There's a point in the New 52
mm-hmm.
where the timelines of the Robins don't make sense.
Yeah.
But there's a point at which there's an argument to be made that in the same way as you're saying Robin is a role, Robin is basically Batman's cannon fodder.
Yeah.
And the idea that he's run through five Robins in 5 years, there's actually a story there if someone really wanted to go after it.
Right.
Pretty dark and a little crazy, but there's something there that I think could be turned into a story if you attempt to make sense of the timeline that he's churned through that many Robins in that short a period of time.
Yeah.
There's potentially something there.
We're talking about All-Star Batman and Robin. Asbar.
Yeah, there's some truth there.
He made Robin eat a rat.
The things you do. So back to other versions of Robin that we like more.
Yes, back to good versions of Robin.
I do think there's something to be said that of these 16, again, not the top 16, but these 16 sidekicks that Paul picked for this bracketology, five of them are Teen Titans.
Yes.
Which is really sort of the ultimate sidekick book. And I love what, over time, Teen Titans in the 60s was the sidekicks getting together to A, have little mini adventures, and B, to grouse about their...
I was going to say, stick it to the superheroes.
You know, certainly grouse and complain about their superheroes.
I'm pretty sure that they had a treehouse. A couch that they just sat on and complained.
But I love the fact that they went from, really, the teen sidekicks, under the Wolfman Perez era especially, to become young adult heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a terrific transition. And that's one of the things that the long arc of comic books can do, is tell those
mm-hmm.
long stories where you see the passage of time.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what makes me sad when sidekicks do get stuck in this perpetual cycle of kid sidekick, you know, of when characters get stuck in that role, because that role, it's tied to age. It's supposed to be transitory, that you're supposed to
right.
be there and then move through it, to grow up, to learn, to be mentored, and then to go out on your own as a hero. And the fact that that doesn't always happen is unfortunate.
So that's our discussion of the 16 sidekicks as given to us by Paul O'Connor over at Longbox Graveyard. We had a few quibbles with the list. For example, we agree that perhaps Snapper Carr really didn't deserve to be on there. But if you're going to remove Snapper and put in a new 16th seed, who would you have replaced him with?
You know, I think I've got to go with Mr. Boy from Sky High. All-American Boy. Because he does not get nearly the respect that he deserves, as proven by a 100-minute movie where he is continually not awesome.
To be fair, that's a 100-minute movie that is 100 minutes of awesome.
Ew, my God, yes. And he saves a baby! So there you go. He gets a moment. One moment.
When we came up with this topic of sidekicks, we were kicking around. We're going to talk about sidekicks and what do we want to do? Do we want to bring an example, talk about stories? Emily said we have to talk about Sky High.
Absolutely, because it is, as I said at the beginning of this episode, the greatest story about sidekicks, I think, ever. It's a incredible movie and should be watched in a double feature with The Incredibles because they both take a similar sort of perspective and tone towards superheroes and like the genre of superhero comics and the tropes and types of characters that you find in those and stories and all that stuff. And they both take this sort of, I don't even want to call it deconstruction because it's very lighthearted and still very much in the tone of comic books, of slightly ridiculous, rather silly, but still genuinely moving with characters that you actually like. And I love it. It's phenomenal.
And the plot itself is actually pretty good. The action-adventure part of the plot,
mm-hmm.
upon which the humor and the other parts hang, is actually pretty good for a superhero movie.
And the movie does something that I think is actually really impressive, that it manages to blend all of the tropes and characters and arcs and all that stuff that you would expect in a superhero film, and all of the tropes and characters and arcs from a typical coming-of-age high school drama movie. And neither one really loses out to the other.
And in terms specifically of this episode, you know, a lot of that movie is about the division between sidekicks and heroes, with sidekicks really the second-class citizens of the school. So you have the teen angst, you have some light bullying angles,
mm-hmm.
you have all of those aspects of the high school drama, but you have this superhero and specifically this sidekick notion as well that we thought really fit in with this episode. You love Dave Foley, as you mentioned.
Yes.
Who, the All-American Boy, or Mr. Boy,
yes.
who teaches the sidekick class.
Ah, wait. Hero support.
Who teaches the hero support class, which included montage lessons of how to change your clothes really fast.
Mm-hmm. How to use a utility belt, the proper linguistic composition of a holy insert object insert adjective man, which is actually one of my favorite sight gags. The whole movie is full of these sight gags and like really rapid, just dropped lines and references to things. Their science teacher is their mad science teacher. But he has a thing for twins, particularly evil twins. Like,
as do we all.
As do we all. A lot of those little quick jokes deal with this issue. But you do feel like this sidekick and hero divide is actually pretty serious. Because of the context, it's sort of funny, but there is a pretty serious scene where our main character, Will, the son of the commander, who is their...
Kurt Russell.
Yes, who is Kurt Russell as sort of Superman-like, where Will has to basically come out and tell his dad, I do not have any superpowers. I know I've always made it look like I had super strength like you, and I've always sort of pretended that I did so you wouldn't be disappointed in me. But I don't have any powers. Because I don't have any powers, it means I'm a sidekick. I don't have any chance of becoming a hero. And his dad is really upset and confused and doesn't know how to feel about this. And he's like, no, you're going to be fine. You'll get your powers. You'll become a hero. It's going to be all, everything's going to be all right. And the son, you know, he's had a few scenes where he's been dealing with this problem of, oh my gosh, I'm just a sidekick. No one's ever going to respect me. I don't even get to choose my own name or color scheme. That's determined by the hero. I am never going to amount to anything. But in that moment, he actually goes, you know what? No, I'm proud to be a sidekick. I have an important role to fill, and I'm proud of being a sidekick. Actually, I'm proud of being hero support. And it's one of those cheesy moments, but there's actually something there that you're like, oh, good for you.
And did we mention Linda Carter as the principal?
Yeah, I think that's why Scott Gardner likes that movie so much.
I'm almost certain that is why Scott Gardner likes that movie so much.
Regardless, it is still a great movie, if only because it has one of the best names for an anti-hero ever. War and Peace.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
That is not bad. And I think of War and Peace as the son of Dr. Doom and Sue Storm Richards von Doom. So our recommendation is rent, view, see, steal. Don't steal.
Do not steal.
Sky High. It's a good movie.
It is. It's very good. It's a little cheesy, but not in the same sort of ironic bad movie sort of cheesy. Like, it's fun and cheesy. And Bruce Campbell. So there you go.
It's sidekickerific.
It is indeed sidekickerific. That is a awful term.
If you have any thoughts or feedback about sidekicks in general, our thoughts on sidekicks, our thoughts on Sky High.
Your favorite sidekicks, sidekicks that should have made the cut.
Send that information to us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com.
You can find our website with all of these episodes and added little links and pictures and stuff at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Or you can find us in iTunes. Just search for Relatively Geeky or Shortbox Showcase.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, guys. Because I have never watched The Simpsons. What? What? Step to me. Step to me.
RelativelyGeeky@gmail.com.
Even that's the winning phrase. It's easier to edit out than edit in. Okay. But I've always sort of imagined that, like, Barry sort of stays close to Central City and looks over the city as he's, you know, slowed down by a few degrees of Mach. Should I say that again? Because I think that wasn't quite a sentence.
Okay, try it again.
No, maybe, it's...
Oh, you're Frank. No, it's Frank you're Miller. I was thinking All-Star Superman.
No. No, that was good. Robin has a battle axe!
To be fair, that's kind of cool.
It's not cool. It's just really scary because it's like at that moment that you realize, oh, Dick Grayson has PTSD and a 35-pound double-bladed battle axe. This isn't going to end well.
What? Do you want to segue into Sky High at this point?
I was just thinking that. Ooh, do you want to say...
I was going to say, now, if Batman were looking for new, since he keeps losing Robins, what do you think he would go to find new Robins? Well, where do you think he goes?
See, well, I was going to make the joke. It's like, you know what... Who should have been at least number 16, at least making the list instead of Snapper Carr, Mr. Boy.